because I'm no longer on the Planning Commission. I am here now to torment you on alternative compliance is the first topic.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. I have four things I want to talk about. Alternative compliance, consistency with state water board direction, seeing what the housing, seeing what the water board can do to help facilitate housing moving forward. And then the last thing is making sure Dave has enough staff. Those are the four topics. Well, you got to try. So the first one is the building industry has partnered with the water board for 100 years to try and get alternative compliance underway, and we just have failed. There's nothing happening in San Diego. I haunted city staff for 8 years right after the board adopted the ability to do permitting responsible alternative compliance, and we got nowhere. And the reason is because the upfront expense is so high, and arguably the usability of it is too confined to things like watersheds and we'll call it confined use of property for multiple use. So it's made it too hard and too expensive for people to proceed. So the ask here this morning is to continue to partner with your staff to get the city of San Diego to do a pilot program. Then they just finished their EIR. Oh my God, I'm sorry, I'm not going fast enough. They just finished the EIR public review to allow for sale credits. So that should be doable, but that's the first request. Second one is, this is what happens when you print out your own papers without the assistance of your staff. This is the State Water Board direction on wetland definitions and procedures. It contains provisions for ensuring consistency between the regional boards and the State Water Board direction. Because the time is short, I won't go into details other than to say that we do have an MSCP plan and we do have a vernal pool HCP here, which should be honored when we are proceeding with mitigation discussions. The third thing is just on process. Let's not use the pre-application process as a screening tool. If your application is complete, that should be good enough. If there's something in it that the staff doesn't agree with, that can be processed later in the going forward. But let's not use that as a reason to not accept an application and add needless delay. And then the fourth thing is for Dave. We're here to help when it comes to securing legislative support and authorization for, let's call it, paid positions. It's done all over government where you have, say, Caltrans in particular, or Sandag, or city and the county. They fund positions. We want to make sure that continues because anything we can do to leverage staff is a good thing. And that's all I have. I'll take any questions. Thank you. And Matt, I talked as long as I could.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Matt Adams isn't here yet, right? Is Matt Adams here? I'm sorry, we have somebody on Zoom, I think. I'm looking to see.
Good morning, Chair Cantu. Thank you for your patience while we sort through the technology barriers on this. We're also glad to have Abby Pacina join us today. She's in training to help fill in for Chris. And we are checking to see right now if we have any speakers who wish to address the board in public forum on Zoom.
I just allowed Mike Beenan to speak.
Yes, good morning. Mike Beenan, Laguna Blue Belt Coalition. Education does not work for people who don't care. We're requesting the board to reopen and revise the investigative order R9-2020-0265 to require OC Parks and Aliso Watershed co-permittees to enforce protection of the Aliso berm from unpermitted breaching. Aliso Beach, among other things, is the designated MS4 flood control outlet and essential for safe public access to all beaches. The previous order recommending education and referral to other agencies fails to fulfill the board's role to regulate discharges from MS4 outlets to state marine protected areas serving as areas of special biological significance, or ASBS. Unfortunately, the order was predicated on faulty comparative analysis between Aliso Beach, Monarch Beach, and Poche. Although Poche Beach had the highest fecal indicator bacteria levels, it's been closed for several years. Access requires parking across Coast Highway with 12 sites before entering a flooded tunnel with urban runoff just to reach the rocky beach. Likewise, Monarch Beach has only private access to a 1.5 mile height, so it is rarely visited. Aliso Beach, however, has around 100 parking sites along the wide, long sandy beach immediately off of Coast Highway. Aliso Beach is a destination for thousands of diverse beach visitors and families from all over Southern California and beyond. Education does not work for people who don't care. The situation demands enforcement. As the Coastal Commission wrote, the issue is not complicated. We are recommending one lifeguard remain at the berm until officers are arrived, so there's a witness for ticketing the offenders. We have invested over $10,000 in education and monitoring last fall, but unpermitted breaching continues. Volunteers seeking to educate vandals are often confronted by hostility from individuals brandishing shovels. Please reopen and revise R92020-0265 to require timely enforcement action this summer and beyond. Thank you. Next slide. You can see him digging in the distance, lifeguards educate and then just walk away. The next slide. You can see the lifeguards walking away. Thank you very much, and please step up enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Beeman. You know, this has been a frustrating situation for us because it appears we don't have the authority to be able to respond to your request. We understand you have an issue that we are sympathetic to. Unfortunately, recreation at that beach is also a protected beneficial use. So we find ourselves without the ability to move forward. Thank you for your continued vigilance on this, but in the meantime, we don't perceive being able to do anything else at this time. Thank you.
Can we direct him to somebody who does have the authority to do what he wishes?
Who might that be?
Good morning, Chair Cantu, Henry Barbanel. We have previously communicated to Mr. Beeman that this is an issue of the County of Orange, and the County of Orange, which oversees the lifeguard services, are the appropriate agency. The ordinances are their ordinances, not ours, nor do we have the ability to enforce the compliance of those ordinances through Orange County. This was all provided in some rather detailed letters we sent to Mr. Beeman, which for your convenience, I've recirculated from our November executive officer's report. We've also included the most recent letter from the Coastal Commission, which unfortunately relied upon rather outdated information, but did recommend and encourage the County of Orange to address this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other members of the public who wish to address the board? Please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Matthew Adams. I'm here on behalf of the Building Industry Association of San Diego County. We have a serious housing crisis. The state of California has declared a housing emergency and made the approval and construction of more homes, especially affordable and middle-income homes, a policy priority for all state agencies and local jurisdictions. San Diego alone has to build 108,000 new units over the next 8 years. Think about that number for a minute, 108,000. Needless to say, it's a Herculean effort that requires all disciplines to perform at their maximum efficiency and effectiveness if we're going to have any chance of tackling this crisis. The Water Board is no exception, and the BIA is very appreciative of the positive dialogue that we are having with your staff to improve the process. Regulatory consistency among natural resource regulating agencies is essential to make all of this work. We ask all agencies to refrain from the temptation to require additional mitigation beyond state and federal regulations. Some jurisdictions call it reach codes, others call it something else. State Water Board underscored its policy in Resolution 2019-0015, where it said a water quality control plan adopted by the State Water Board supersedes a water quality control plan adopted by a regional board. At present, the City of San Diego is pursuing an alternative compliance program. Unfortunately, it's being tailored in a way where builders will be unable to use it due to upfront expense compared with conventional treatment. One way to address this, the State Water Board provide flexibility in mitigating outside watersheds. This alone would broaden the attractiveness to buyers and should be allowed here in San Diego. Besides being allowed to mitigate across watersheds, other key measures needed is allowing multiple beneficial uses on the same property, such as habitat, stormwater, carbon farming. BA met with the EPA and they confirmed that its national policy is to allow multiple uses on the same property. The best way to move forward is for the board to work with the City of San Diego and the regulated community to do a pilot program for alternative compliance so that developers can buy into it. Otherwise, everything remains on site and creativity is lost. The city has completed its CEQA review for its programmatic EIR for alternative compliance, but challenges remain. Just one last line. The BIA asked for resolution to policy differences between the state and regional water board, and we very much appreciate the ongoing dialogue with staff. These are clearly complicated issues. And we ask for board support for staff's efforts to develop an alternative compliance program. Thank you very much.
Two questions.
Henry.
For Mr. Adams. You mentioned that the BIA is having a positive dialogue with the regional board staff. I'm glad to hear that. Can you elaborate on what that dialogue is about?
That dialogue is about trying to improve the process in terms of working with the City of San Diego to develop an alternative compliance program. The issues that are raised are still issues that are being discussed. We most recently just had a meeting with your staff to go over that and other components. And it's that kind of exchange of ideas that we believe ultimately can result in a positive program that one, the builders can use, and two, will have a superior biological benefit, which in the long run is what we're all striving to achieve.
My other question has to do with, are you familiar with the wetlands policy adopted by this board?
Not specifically.
The wetlands policy is to have net meaningful gain of wetlands, not simply trading one wetland for another. Are you, perhaps you could become more familiar with the policy and help us out?
Sure. Well, Mr. Whalen is very adept to it and very familiar with it. But, you know, it's avoid, minimize, and mitigate is your standard wetland policy.
I understand, but that's not the policy.
But this board exceeds it, right?
Yes, it does.
Right. Well, that gets to my earlier point where, and it's not alone in this jurisdiction. I have this discussion with jurisdictions all over the county where they want to exceed state and federal regulations, which is a noble effort, but it comes at a cost. And the cost is our inability to provide middle-income housing, which is the sole focus of the BIA these days. So all these additional regulations, while noble, do come at a price, and it's adding to the chasm between affordability and market rate. And we've got to get product on the ground that people can actually afford to buy. And it's hard to do when you get layers upon layers upon layers of regulations. That's all we're saying.
Thank you, Mr. Adams.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Any other members of the public wish to address this board in cyberspace? Okay, let's move forward with our board business. We'll consider the adoption of the meeting minutes of March the 9th. Is there a first and a second to adopt those minutes, please?
Will we adopt them?
Second.
Thank you. Will the clerk call the roll?
Mr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. Motion carries. Our second order of business is our chairs, member, board members, and state board liaisons presentations to this group. And I would like to invite our state liaison,
who Nicole is attending multiple regional meetings today. She's with Region 6 right now. She'll join us right after.
Okay. So after other reports or after the board meeting? I don't understand.
Right after she's done with Region 6.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you're monitoring that. Thank you very much. I'll invite our board members, our colleagues. Do you have anything to report since our last meeting? We have no additional reports. I'll make a very brief report. The chairs and vice chairs of all the regional boards are invited to Sacramento on May 20th to have a confab to talk about our joint priorities and concerns and also to celebrate the anniversary of the Clean Water Act. So it's going to be an interesting time. It's a full day affair. We'll get a chance to see each other in person after a very long time. And they have a very interesting agenda planned for us. So you'll look forward to a report back. Vice Chair Betty Olson and I are planning on attending, and we'll let you know how it goes when we come back. At this point, we'll call on the Executive Officer's report.
Good morning, Chair Cantu, members of the board. I'd like to ask if you have any questions on the written report you received or the supplemental report. I have a couple of things to share with you. First of all, I'd like to ask the board to join me in congratulating Charles Chang on his, again, retirement. He retired and came back to us for a short time. We were glad to have his services, but now he has retired and is looking forward to traveling and visiting with his family. So that will be a big change for him and for us. We are also happy to congratulate Helen Yu on her promotion to Senior Water Resource Control Engineer Specialist, unfortunately, in Region 5. Patrick Palupo owes me a beer, I think, on that one. We are right now actively recruiting for those vacancies. And with regard to the border issues, I've also now arranged through our staff to meet with Martha Guzman, the Regional Administrator of Region 9, next Thursday to talk about trash issues in Tijuana that we might be able to address through several approaches, which we have. Right now, it's a trash TMDL in development, which is undergoing OCC review. And we are also working with the Cal EPA and State Water Board on potential projects for Senate Bill 170, which includes perhaps one or two trash projects in Smuggler's Gulch, Matadero Canyon, or the main channel itself. I'm hoping to have some more news and some definitive information to share with you at an upcoming meeting on that. But I'm very glad to report we've had very productive dialogue and discussions with the International Boundary and Water Commission, who have agreed to allow access to the channel for that. And so far, the project seems to be favorably received, and we are looking forward to a full proposal being submitted by the County of San Diego as the project proponent there in that channel. Again, a multi-agency approach to a longstanding problem has always been the heart of the Tijuana River Valley Recovery Strategy, and this would be an excellent opportunity to make good on those long-term investments. And then finally, on June 3rd, I will be presenting before the Industrial Environmental Association annual meeting and training on border issues, big surprise. I will also be conducting a boat tour of San Diego Bay celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. And I'll be able to share with the attendees there, as I did with the WQCC last year, that San Diego Bay, because of this board's efforts in large part, but not exclusively, is healthier now than it's been in the last 50 years because of progressive efforts to address shipyard discharges, stormwater discharges, industrial discharges, cleanups of San Diego Bay, for example, 500,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediments with PCBs, et cetera, removed from the bay. So there's a lot of success stories to celebrate there, and we'll be looking for opportunities to do that. And I'm hoping I've bought enough time now for Nicole Morgan, our state board liaison, to be able to join us from Region 6 after her presentation there. She is not. Perhaps we can come back to her a little bit later on, maybe after one of the other items.
Dave, is your presentation of the boat tour being recorded or filmed so we can share it?
That would be wonderful. Judging from the audio problems we had last time, I doubt it. But if we can, I will ask IEA if that's possible.
Okay, great.
That's a very good idea. Okay, well, we'll see if we can revisit our state board representative at a different time. So at this point, we'll move into our consent agenda. We have one issue on our consent agenda, waste discharge requirement rescission, rescission of order 94-48, waste discharge requirement for SKP Incorporated. Is there anybody from the board who wishes to draw that from the consent agenda? Or from the public? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Thank you.
Seconded, Gary.
Thank you. Is there any, are there any questions or discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Mr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. Motion carries. We have several informational items that we're looking forward to today. We're going to take them in a different order than what they are published for the convenience of presentation. So the first one will be number 6 on your agenda, the San Diego River Watershed Update Part 3, the San Diego River Conservancy Update on its efforts to preserve, restore, enhance the San Diego River area. Mr. Gibson, will you introduce this item?
Thank you, Chair Cantu. I'm very happy to introduce Julie Richards from the San Diego River Conservancy, one of our fellow state agencies that oversees many fascinating projects in the San Diego River watershed. Very pleased, and would like to ask the board to join me in thanking her for appearing today, because her board of directors meet tomorrow. And that can always be a lot of stress putting those meetings together. I really appreciate her making the time for us today. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you. Dave.
Chair Cantu and members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the San Diego River Conservancy's Wildfire and Forest Resilience Program. Could we go back to the first slide, please? One more back, sir. There we go. Thank you so much. The photos on this slide are from the 2003 Cedar Fire in San Diego County. Next slide, please. California is facing a growing forest and wildfire crisis. Decades of fire suppression, coupled with the increasing impacts of climate change, have dramatically increased the size and intensity of wildfires. How do we reduce the risk to our communities? Next slide, please. By being better prepared. Some activities will reduce the risk and intensity of fires, include actions such as creating fire breaks in defensible space, removing dead, diseased, and dying trees, removing invasive non-native vegetation, prescribed and pile burning, improve forest health, procure fire-related equipment to assist in fire prevention and suppression, and public outreach to homeowners in the wildland-urban interface zone. Conservancy partners are already implementing these types of projects through weed abatement, brush management, and supporting healthy ecosystems. Healthy ecosystems include forest, woodlands, grasslands, chaparral, shrublands, and related vegetation types. Next slide, please. The Wildfire and Forest Resilience Action Plan is a comprehensive strategy of the Governor's Forest Task Management Force. It was released in January 2021. The plan's goals are to restore the health and resilience of California forests, grasslands, and natural places, and improve the fire safety of our communities. All projects under this program must achieve one or more goals of the action plan. Next slide, please. In the past year, the Conservancy's governing board approved 9 projects for a total of $18 million. San Diego River Conservancy funding was provided by the budget acts of 2020 and 2021. Next slide, please. Oh, this map's a little dark, but the stars show project sites that are mainly focused in the San Diego River watershed. Conservancy-funded wildfire projects provide multi-benefits, such as reducing the risk of wildfire, strengthening community protection, safeguarding water and air quality, protecting fish and wildlife habitat, improving climate resilience, enhancing biodiversity, and improving recreational opportunities. Next slide, please. Here is a list of approved projects being implemented by nonprofit organizations, government agencies, and fire departments. Through the Wildfire and Forest Resilience Program, these projects will provide the following deliverables: fuel reduction and vegetation management on 28,066 acres of public land, chipping in defensible space on 1,300 acres of private lands serving 400 homeowners, one fire engine, two brush rigs, two command vehicles, two pickup trucks, trailers for equipments, three Bobcat and skid steers, and one digital fire extinguisher for community training purposes. One example of a project I'd like to highlight would be San Diego Canyonlands. They were awarded approximately $1 million for San Diego River Watershed Canyons Fire Resilience Program. The project includes reducing fuel loads in the city of San Diego's open space and targeted areas, including Ruffin, San Rock, Rueda, Shepherd, and Navajo Canyons for approximately 1,110 acres. Within the city-owned land are brush management zones located adjacent to private property owners. Providing fuel breaks in this area reduces the risk of fire while maintaining a healthy habitat value throughout the canyon's ecosystem. This project also includes a social workforce program components. These participants will receive on-the-job training in all types of brush management that will make them eligible for similar work in the private sector and in government agencies. Their workforce partners include Price Foundation, San Diego Center for Children, and Department of Rehabilitation. Next slide, please. This slide shows one approved project and one project being considered at the Conservancy's board meeting tomorrow. One project we would like to highlight with Cumier de Guigno Land Conservancy. They had worked with various bands, including the Campo Fire Protection District, the Humul Indian Village, the Manzanita Band of the Kumeyaay Nation, the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians, and Sequan Band of Kumeyaay Nation. These Kumeyaay bands are located within the San Diego River, Sweetwater River, and Tijuana River watersheds. The Cumeyaay de Guigno Land Conservancy worked with these tribes and identified the need for fire department vehicles and mechanical equipment to help reduce fuel loads on the reservations. These reservations are located in the high fire risk area. The project also includes procurement of other fire-related equipment and workforce training for tribal monitors. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, our partners have been implementing these types of projects since 2009 when the invasive non-native removal program started. Under this program in 2022, the Conservancy partners will implement 11 projects on approximately 170 acres to reduce the overgrowth of invasive plants, which are highly flammable. Next slide, please. The Conservancy would like to thank its partners and organizations for stepping up to help strengthen community protection in the San Diego River area. Next slide, please. I appreciate the opportunity to update the chair and the board today. I'm ready to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Richards? I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So the San Diego River Conservancy is acting as a pass-through for the state funds.
Yes.
And then you invite and vet these different proposals and work with them through implementation, or exactly what is your role there?
Thank you, Chairwoman. So you're correct. We received, due to the budget surplus, we received additional funds that are general funds that are more broadly able to be spent, as opposed to specific bond funds that require local assistance or capital outlay. Currently, we have an ongoing grant program called the Directed Grant Program, mm-hmm. that is posted on our website with concept proposals. staff answers any questions. So far, we've received about 8 different proposals requesting $10 million. So it's a wide variety of projects, not just wildfire, but nature-based solution, water quality, kind of the whole gamut of our program areas within the Conservancy. But to directly answer your question, yes, it's like a pass-through grant program. Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that your program is oversubscribed. You have more demand than dollars to solve the problems?
Yes, ma'am. You are correct.
And were you given additional staff to be able to administer this increased load? Or are you doing that within your current capacity?
We are doing it within our current capacity, ma'am.
Uh-huh.
No additional staff at this time.
Right. Yeah. Well, good luck. This is good work, important work, and we appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity again.
Julia, if you can, I'd like to add that her staff is Julia and 2 others. So
that's what I was thinking.
3. Okay.
But as your suggestion had said, and some of our board member recognized with the increased workload, we will be requesting additional permission. But as of course, that has to go through the budget process and Department of Finance.
Good luck.
Thank you, ma'am.
See you tomorrow.
Bye, Gary.
Thank you. Gary Schramm is our representative to the San Diego River Conservancy. Do you have anything else you'd like to add? I should have invited you first.
No, ma'am. Julia did a great job of it. This was a step away from what we normally do, which is like normally the grants, the process coming out of Sacramento are very specified, you know, about water quality or parks. And then this was an influx of money, a significant influx of money. So we had to change the priorities and look at fire prevention. And the proposals that have come in from our view were excellent. And the staff's work on screening those and trimming them, some of the excess out and getting as much bang for the bucks is commendable. She's doing a great job. And I think the results from what I see along the river are very visible and it's been a rush, but a very good process. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And thank you for your continued involvement in keeping us informed on that good work. Our next agenda item will be number 7, the San Diego River Watershed Update Part 4, update on the status of investigative order number Region Board 9-2019-0014. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Am I sharing?
Pardon
me,
so.
I'm trying to figure out how to share this with those on the internet.
Sorry. Where are you? This is you, right?
Well, good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. I am Jimmy Smith. And I am serving as this board's liaison to the named entities who are trying to identify the sources and quantify the loading of human fecal waste to the lower San Diego River. Today, you'll receive an update on their efforts to comply with the investigative order that was issued by this board in June of 2019. I'll provide a brief introduction to the watershed and to the many challenges we face with trying to achieve safe to swim. And then John Griffith of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project will provide the bulk of the technical update. This time, I'd like to remind the audience that this is an informational item and the board will not be taking an action. So here we are in the lower San Diego watershed right here. As depicted by this little icon, the water board sign, we are just below the B in boards right there. And the investigative order does focus on the lower portion of the San Diego River watershed. As seen here, it is the watershed below both San Vicente and El Capitan reservoirs. There are numerous beneficial uses in the watershed, and they are listed here in the light blue box on the top corner. The watershed does empty into the Pacific at Ocean Beach, and this estuary also has several beneficial uses. I'd like to note that both the estuary and the river have contact recreation as one of their beneficial uses. Unfortunately, the beach and the lower main stem of the river and the tributary known as Forester Creek are all listed on the Clean Water Act Section 303D list for impaired water bodies due to indicator bacteria. Ocean Beach at the end of the river is one of Southern California's most iconic and popular beaches for all kinds of contact recreation. Just to the north of Ocean Beach, across the channel, and across the river mouth is Mission Beach and Pacific Beach, also enjoying experiences quite a bit of use. And given the location of these beaches, they probably see a higher use by those coming from environmental justice, low income, and disadvantaged communities. So the high use of those beaches was just one of the reasons why this board has consistently designated indicator bacteria as a priority. Total maximum daily loads were adopted in 2002 and 2010 for bacteria-related impairments in the San Diego, Lower San Diego River and associated beaches. Safe to swim was identified in the 2017 resolution on key uses as a priority, with oceans and bays listed as a rank one key area. And human waste and sanitary sewer overflows are routinely selected as the highest enforcement priority of this board. In 2014, a surfer health study was conducted to better understand actual illness rates among those who routinely contact ocean waters. And that seminal investigation revealed that going surfing within 72 hours of a rain event resulted in 12 additional illnesses per 1,000 exposures over a background of 18. So this led to a wet weather microbial source tracking investigation in 2016 and 2017. This chart shows the main stem of the San Diego River as a vertical line from inland down to the Pacific Ocean, with each of the dots representing a sampling station. And each of these dots also represent the mass of HF-183 encountered at these sampling stations. And as you can imagine, the bigger the dot, the greater the mass. And we should note that HF-183 was present throughout most of the watershed. This is a similar slide, same kind of sampling station, same diagram, but now we're looking at concentrations of HF-183. And we show concentrations because I think it shows a little better the ubiquitous nature of HF-183 and human waste throughout the entire watershed. It should be noted at the most downstream station, which was at Ingram Street, the average concentration of HF-183 was on par with the average concentration going into the Point Loma sewage treatment plant. Around the same time, this board participated in a cost-benefit analysis to determine the best way to meet the dry weather contact recreation total maximum daily load. And it should come as no surprise that source abatement was the preferred alternative and the best way to control human waste. So all of that led to this board issuing an investigative order in June of 2019 to identify sources and quantify the loading of human waste to the lower river. Now, the order didn't contain a lot of specific requirements, only the submission of a work plan, progress reports, and a final conceptual model enumerating the various sources of human waste. Several entities were named in the order, and they are working collaboratively to comply with the directives of the order. And some of them are here today. Potential sources identified in the order include sanitary sewer overflows, or SSOs, Exfiltration, which is a type of SSO, leaking private laterals, on-site waste treatment systems, also known as septic systems, illicit connections and illicit discharges, and homeless encampments. The board at the time of the adoption also created a subcommittee consisting of board members Gary Strawn and Dr. Betty Olson to follow developments more closely as the investigations proceeded. So now I'd like to share a little bit more about what we know about those potential sources in the watershed to demonstrate the extent of the challenge we are facing. These GIS images come from that aforementioned cost-benefit analysis. And here we see all the sewer mains within the watershed, with approximately 3,000 miles of sewer mains in the lower San Diego watershed. Now here we see both the mains and the laterals, and they have been prioritized based on threat to water quality from distance from the stream or storm drain, soil type, pipe diameter, and pipe age. So the red areas represent high priority areas or potential hotspots. We move on now to showing category one sanitary sewer overflows and private lateral sewage discharges from the period of 2007 to 2016. The average volume of sewage reaching the San Diego River was 15,000 gallons per year, with another 2,600 gallons coming from those private laterals. Now we know that those private lateral numbers are probably a gross underestimate, given the voluntary nature of the reporting requirement. Now we see an image of the on-site waste treatment systems or septic systems. And believe it or not, there are over 11,000 in the watershed, most of them in the upper portion, but there are quite a few down in the lower portion of the watershed as represented by these purple dots. This slide shows population density, and most of the lower river is in the medium to dark brown, representing 500 to over 6,000 people per square mile in the watershed. Now we know most of that population is housed, but we also know there are probably 200 to 300 folks who are unhoused in the watershed. We'll hear a little bit more about that later from John. This slide shows our extensive storm drain system. And I guess the takeaway from this is anything deposited in the watershed is very likely to make it into the beaches and the creek during wet weather. So to date, the work plan was approved in May of 2020, and all required progress reports have been submitted. The board subcommittee met last month, and we do plan to meet a few more times moving forward. So I won't say too much about this slide, because I know John's going to show this to you again and get into quite a bit of detail about some of these investigations. So for now, just kind of familiarize yourself with the various categories and what we're going to hear soon. I would like to emphasize that all the work being conducted is original research. And some of the investigations require development of new engineering apparatus and the application of novel cutting edge science. So I can take some questions now, or I can introduce John and we can come back to any questions you may have later.
Any questions for Mr. Smith? Thank you.
All right. So Dr. John Griffith is head of SCORP's microbiology department and coordinator of molecular technology. His research efforts focus on development and evaluation of methods for detection and enumeration of fecal indicators and pathogens in fresh and marine waters, and relationships between water quality indicators and swimming-related illness. He has written over 60 articles on the use of foraminifera as bioindicators, prokaryotic and viral diversity in marine plankton, beach water quality, microbial source tracking, and relationships between water quality and swimming-related illness. He received his BS in environmental studies and biology and his PhD in marine biology and biological oceanography from the University of Southern California. John has been with SCORP since 2001.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Griffin.
Hi, thank you. Excited to be here. Can you help me get my slides up, please? Oh, sorry, Joe.
Chris, you're going to have to do the screen share. It should be gone. Maybe.
Great. Thank you. Okay, it's great to be here to update you on our work on the investigative order on behalf of the named parties. Let's go ahead. First, I just want to go over the technical approach to the investigative order. It names all the human sources to be quantified, but it, as Jimmy said, it doesn't spell out the technical details. And so there's a good deal of original research that goes into trying to measure these different sources. And then the desire at the end, of course, is to have a pie chart, right? So looking at the relative contribution of all the different sources rather than looking at point sources in the watershed. And so you have seen this before, basically seven identified human sources, and you'll see these again, so I'm not gonna go over them again. But I did want to talk about SCWRP's role. And our role is really, we were asked by the named parties to create a work plan to satisfy the needs of the IO and then to deliver the technical foundation to be able to complete the work. We aren't addressing any implementation actions, although our work, I'm sure, will be used to guide those implementation actions by the named parties. We also were asked to facilitate a steering committee of the named parties, the regulators, and non-governmental NGOs, and then convene a technical review committee. We have done so, and it's comprised of national thought leaders in this work across the United States. There we go. So what are the goals? Well, first, quantify all loading from human fecal contamination from the different sources that were listed. And this is focused mostly on wet weather, although we did have done some dry weather work also to look at illicit discharges and possible cross connections. Then use the loading extents to compare the relative contributions of each of the sources of fecal inputs. And try to identify which are the major sources which will guide the implementation of abatement. And then finally, identify the factors that might lead to the greatest risk of loading. And look at where and when do we see the greatest loading. So where are we on this? Well, for sanitary sewer exfiltration, we've developed research tools that we're now applying to be able to measure down to about a quart of loss of sewage from an in-ground sewer pipe when we run over 1,000 gallons of water through it, which is kind of simulates wet weather conditions in the pipe. And so we've done several sites now, and that work is ongoing. With homeless populations, we're conducting census and survey work, looking at the sanitary habits of the unhoused folks. And we've started wet weather sampling, and I'll actually be giving you some data on that today. With private sewer laterals, we are just beginning. We are initiating a sampling program, and we have a subcommittee of the steering committee that is looking at how to implement that program. We'll be meeting on May 17th. And then in terms of on-site wastewater treatment systems, septic systems, that sampling has been completed, and so we're starting data analysis on that. With sanitary sewer overflows, we've completed our initial analysis of the data. And then with illicit connections and illegal discharges, that was dry weather work. That work has actually been completed, and I'll be talking about that today too. So I have three milestones I'm going to talk about today. The first is the illicit discharges, the dry weather work. And the take-home message from that is that dry weather was really a non-problem. We saw very few human sources during dry weather, and the ones that we did see, there was an explanation for. And so I just want to talk about that first. So our approach for estimating human contributions from illicit connections or illegal dumping was to sample receiving waters during dry weather. And the idea was to see how widespread human contributions were. We had multiple sampling campaigns. We did a late summer campaign when it's dry after a first storm, and then at the end of the wet season to look at if there was seasonal variability. And then where we found hits, we connected follow-up work to identify sources, and hits were defined as 500 gene copies of the HF183 marker. This is the marker that's most widely used for detecting human sewage, and 500 gene copies is because recent work by Ali Baim and Jeff Soler at Stanford has identified 500 copies as about the risk level that you should be concerned about. Right? We don't expect to never see any human material in water.
Would you mind going back one slide, please?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Oh, sorry, maybe we skip it. There was the census population of,
there we go.
Sorry. I think we're on that one more. I didn't mean to interrupt this much.
That's all right. So which slide are you looking at?
I think there was a number that said census between 200 and 300 unhoused.
Oh, here. Yeah. Well, I will get to that.
Okay.
So I'll go in order. So you'll see this slide again twice more. Yeah. Don't worry. But thanks for asking. Okay. So here are sampling sites. The original sites are in brown. These sites are the ones that Jimmy showed you from our original work in the Surfer Health Study. But in green, we added a bunch of new sites. And then because this is dry weather and we're looking for water, we also had some alternate sites in case some of our sites were dry that we could go and sample. And in fact, we did end up sampling some of these because sometimes it was quite dry. And so what did we find? Here's a table looking at, these are your original sites, new sites, and the alternate sites on the left. And you can see there are main stems and tributaries listed here. And in summer, BD, this darker green means below detection. We didn't see anything. BLOQ means it's below our level of quantification. So we detected something, but it was so low we couldn't put a number on it. And you should know that our level of quantification is very low in the tens of copies with this method. And if we really want to do more, we get down to one copy. So it's very, very sensitive method if you want to put in the effort. And then with first rain and end of the season, you can see we did get a few places that where we did have hits, over 500, but these were explainable. There were sewage spill in Los Coches, and then homeless encampments here. And at Forester Creek here, there are a lot of campers along the creek. So these are all things that are easily explained by conditions on the ground. So overall, dry weather is not the big problem. Okay. Next thing I want to talk about is people experiencing homelessness. And as you saw, we found that there were about 200 to 300 people living along the main stem in this year during the wet season, and that open defecation appears widespread, but direct deposition, that is actually pooping right in the river, is rare. And so how did we do this? Well, we conducted a census and also surveyed the unhoused population. And the idea is, how many potential contributors do we have? Where and when are they inhabiting the river corridor? And what are their sanitary habits? Then we needed to confirm the homelessness contribution estimates. And so we did upstream and downstream sampling. That's ongoing. So the idea here is to measure the background level upstream of encampment during a rainstorm, and then also downstream of the encampment, and also to know how many persons are actually in that encampment, and then estimate what the contribution is from the encampment. And then also there's some optional wash-off experiments looking for essentially how much would you see if a stream bank latrine were washed out during wet weather. Okay, so what did we find? So this is census work that's done, was done by the River Park Foundation. We're very lucky to be able to work with them because they have such a good knowledge of the river. On the left here are the number of people. These are the different counts going back to 2016. This is actually our census this last wet season. And the dark area is the San Diego area, and then green is Santee. And what you see is that the population does fluctuate, but it's right around between 200 and 300 people right now. My understanding is right here is there were enforcement actions that drove down the population and also some dips because of wet weather. So it turns out people don't stick around in the river. They get their stuff and try to get out because they don't want to get washed away and they don't want to lose their stuff. And so overall, that's about what we're seeing is 200 to 300 people on that main stem. Okay. We also surveyed these folks and have a number of questions about their sanitary habits. So this particular question, there were 63 respondents. The question is, do you or do you know of people living nearby who defecate slash poop within the river corridor? And you can see that many, the answer is yes, most of them do know someone or do themselves poop within the river corridor. Very few were not sure or answered no. And the confidence interval on these is plus or minus 2%. So people are pooping in the river corridor. However, when we asked them about their sanitary habits, how often do they do outdoor defecation? What we see is that 28% said always they poop in the river corridor. 8% said 5 to 6 days a week. 9% said most days. 15% said some days. And then 19% said infrequently, and 21% said only when they had to. But the big take home is, you had about 36% that said always or almost always, but 40% answered infrequently or only when I have to. So you don't have people that are purposely wanting to poop in the river. And that's borne out by this this chart. Over 50% of the people said when they were queried about where do they go to the bathroom, do they typically go in the desert in a designated spot or container? Over 50% said they used a bucket or a bag to contain the waste. Many of them also said that they threw it away in a dumpster or other trash receptacle. Some of these people that are said they're going high ground and low ground closer to the river. Many of them said they buried their feces. You had no one that said that they pooped right in the river. So that was interesting. And when asked, they were cognizant of the fact they were using the river for washing. And so they did not want poop in the river. Okay. Then the last thing I want to talk about are the sanitary sewer biofilms that we've quantified in wet weather. And we did see those in consistently dilute amounts throughout everywhere we sampled during wet weather. And so how did we do this? Well, it turns out that inside sewer pipes is a really unique environment, not just here, but almost everywhere. So this work's also been done in the Great Lakes and been used to track combined sanitary sewer overflows all the way out for miles out into Lake Michigan. But new sequencing technology allows us to quantify these microbial communities from the biofilm in the sewer pipes. And the first thing we needed to do is, even though this work's been done elsewhere, we needed to know, are the biofilms in our sewer pipes different than the biofilms in the storm drains? And it turns out they are. We measured dozens of sites across San Diego in different seasons, and also over time. So we wanted to have spatial and temporal stability. Turns out the biofilm signal and the community inside the sewer pipe stays pretty darn constant. And so if you can quantify the sanitary biofilm in wet weather, then you can use that to confirm raw sewage inputs into the stormwater. And of course, this would trigger increased effort to look at sanitary sewer overflows or exfiltration. So here are sampling sites. And the yellow dots are the mainstream sites and the pink dots are tributaries. And so we have good coverage all the way down the lower watershed. And we took composite samples during wet weather. And so here's kind of what we found. So what you're looking at is the percentage of sequences in the sewage category that we found in the river. And the way we were able to come up with this is we took sewage spike clean storm water. So this is, these gray bars are 1% sewage. This is 0.1% sewage, right? And 100% sewage. And we looked at the proportion of sequences that we found in the environmental sites. And you can see that we have essentially less than 0.1%, but pretty widespread throughout the watershed. And these error bars are the standard deviation on the multiple measurements. And so what this means is we do see this biofilm in the water, and this confirms our previous work looking at the human marker and shows that at least part of the signal we're seeing is from sanitary sewers. So just to remind you where we are, we still have work to do here. We have ongoing work. The census work is mostly done, but we'll be looking at tributaries also to see how many people are up in tributaries. And we've started the wet weather sampling to quantify upstream, downstream inputs. Private laterals will be having our first meeting next week. We've completed sampling on the on-site wastewater treatment systems. Expect on our next briefing, we'll probably have something to say about those. Sanitary sewer overflows work is ongoing, and we are done with the dry weather component, looking for illicit discharges. And so here's where we are on the project. The work plan was approved in May 2020. We're giving semi-annual compliance updates. We've assembled a steering committee. We have a technical review committee that's reviewing our work and giving us independent technical oversight. And then the final project completion date, December 24th, 2024. And as we go along, you know, we are learning, we're revising the way we're doing things to get the best measurements we can, and we will publish these results as we go along. And I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Griffith. Questions?
Are the biofilms the same in the private laterals as the SSOs?
It could be. We have not done any scraping of private laterals. It turns out people are flinchy about getting into their private laterals. I might have to scrape some from my own to actually get it. So, and that's one of the things that we're working with the named parties is how best to approach homeowners and get permission to actually inspect laterals and be able to actually do measurements to see how much they're leaking. So, yes, once we get in there, we will take some samples, for sure.
If I can you go back to the chart on the homeless count? And I'm going to make a couple of comments on it. I don't want to steal Sarah's thunder, but.
Which one?
The chart that showed the
people?
Right before, yeah, right
there. There you are.
Okay, so I've been very involved with this over the years, so I'm going to just make a couple of comments. The general trend and the conclusions are, I think, spot on. The big increase, well, there's a couple of things to show. The counts that we all count, which is a national thing, tend to always be lower than the ones that the River Park did itself. That's understandable because the national one, you have to do every spot on the river within the same 2 hours on the same morning. So the people and the counters are spread thinner. When the River Park does it, we can go out with better crews, more experienced crews, and do it over maybe 2 weekends. So we get a much more thorough count. For example, the very first little green spot, that was in Santee, that was me and Shannon doing the whole city. So in 2 hours, we were on a run. We knew where most of the camps were, but still, it compared to the newer ones where you have experienced teams, 5-6 people each, and experienced leaders. So that explains some of it, the big ups and downs. The other comment I would make is that as the city of San Diego decided to start enforcing some things, it pushed a lot of them east. They just walked around Mission Trails Park and set up their camp on the other side. And the sheriff out there was not interested in pursuing that. I think the new sheriff may change his mind. This is the local sheriff in Santee, not the sheriff. So like anything, we have to look at that and understand it's in a moving environment, and the counting has gotten better. The other thing, and I don't want to steal Sarah Sundron on this, but I want to make sure she comments on it. The poop counts. Mm-hmm. There's some very clear observation differences between camps that are transient and those that are longer established. And also, you know, the idea of pooping in a bucket or a bag isn't, in my view, is not necessarily a good thing. If they poop on the soil and they bury it a little bit, the sun gets at it and it tends to be mitigated some over time. The bucket or the bag, if it flows downstream during the next storm event, is still raw and available. And at some point that bag and that bucket's going to break open. And so that's not something I think we want to encourage. And that's my comments from being in the field.
Oh, those are good observations. They didn't make you part of the team.
Any other questions for Dr. Griffin? I just have a general question. So sure. You worked to characterize this area looking for HF 183. Are you doing geolocation points where you can so that we can turn this into enforcement actions and actually mitigate the situation?
I actually don't know the answer to that question, whether or not River Park would be sharing that information with law enforcement or not.
Well, I was more interested in sharing with us. So, I mean, so that is it actionable? Is it something that at the end of the day, when you're done in 2024?
I'm certain that the places where the encampments are well known. I mean, that's not no secret there. Yeah.
Right. But I was more interested in unpermitted releases and maybe septic tanks that are failing and leaching into the river area.
Those kinds of observations certainly would be in the data, yes. Yeah. If there's a failing septic tank, we would have that information.
That's good to know. Okay. Seems like we have no more questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Do you have anything else, Mr. Schmidt?
No, I do not. There are representatives from several of the named entities here, and they are willing to answer any questions this board may have. Otherwise, Sam, there's here taking it.
Any questions for any of our guests? Okay, so I think at this point, we're gonna interject our state representative's report, Nicole Morgan. I believe she's on standby and is ready to share with us her state board report.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
And thank you. So it is great to join you virtually. However, I am really excited to be coming down there in July. And so we have been, since I joined the State Water Board last year, I have, just been able to join you virtually. I have not made it down to the region. So I'm really excited that I have been working with executive officer with the executive officer to schedule a site visit. And so that's going to happen on July 12th to come down to the region to see, just some of the great work that the region is doing and to hear directly from you just some of the region's priorities, see firsthand what is happening down there and get to see you all in person. And in the future, also just looking forward to being able to come down there for some of your regional board meetings also in person. So, just excited that you are getting back to having in-person meetings and that I'll be able to do that in the future. So as far as State Board, as always, a lot going on. And so we had our State Board meeting yesterday. And let's see here. There was a lot that was covered, and I apologize. I somehow closed the correct document here. Let me get that back open. So yesterday at the meeting, the hot topic as always is drought, and so we received the drought update at the meeting yesterday, and the statewide residential use for statewide residential use for March decreased by 18.9%, which gave us a cumulative savings of 3.7% relative to 2020. That is somewhat not a huge shock just because January, February, March of this year was the driest first 3 months of a calendar year on record. I believe that it was in the last 100 years. When we're comparing the years and the months, that is somewhat understandable. We are looking forward to seeing, how does the data come in as we move into the drier season, and how does, the comparison of water use in that time space looks. On April 21st, staff held a public webinar to provide an overview of the draft proposed emergency regulation on water conservation. And today, staff will hold a public workshop this afternoon on making conservation a California way of life, on the forthcoming efficiency standards and how those may impact local wastewater management. So that starts at 1 p.m. this afternoon. Materials were sent out late yesterday afternoon, and are also available on the State Board's website. And the link to register for the webinar via Zoom is also available on our website. Yesterday, we also readopted a resolution revising and the drought emergency regulations for the Russian River watershed. In the Delta, State Board has been providing weekly updates on curtailment statuses and will continue to do so. On April 19th, water rights staff released emergency draft regulations for the Delta watershed to continue curtailments the board adopted last year. There will be a technical workshop to discuss the proposed regulations on May 12th, which is tomorrow, and public comments are being accepted until May 19th. There's also changing subjects over to water quality. The construction stormwater general permit on March 30th, State Board staff released the proposed statewide construction, the reissuance, the draft there. A public workshop was held on April 12th, and then the State Board held another workshop on April 19th to hear public comment. The public comment period ended on May 12th. We will be considering the readoption of that general permit on July 19th. The other item, we had the arrearages program this past year, and the second part of that was the wastewater arrearages for wastewater arrearages. And so the application period was open through April 22nd. As of April 28th, 251 wastewater systems had applied. Technical assistance is still available for those who need assistance with that program. So that's, the big picture of what's been happening. As always, here for questions, please reach out anytime. And really am looking forward to seeing you all on July 12th. Yes.
Thank you very much. We know that you're attending more than one regional board meeting today simultaneously. So we really appreciate your multitasking to be able to manage this. And we are looking forward to July 12th. We'll have a lot of time to sit down and talk about all of our mutual goals. Any specific questions for our state board representative at this point? Hearing none. I see that our executive officer is looking at me. Do you have something to add?
No, thank you, Chair Cantu. Just looking forward also to being able to take our state board liaison on the tour of the River Valley. And we'll also have a chance to talk about our practical vision, our board's priorities. She'll get a sneak peek at our operations plan for the coming fiscal year. So we'll have a chance to coordinate on several things in anticipation of the WQCC meeting and report out this year.
Thank you. We look forward to that. Thank you very much for your patience and ability to address us while doing multiple tasks. We'll move now. Go ahead.
I was just saying thank you, and thank you for your patience today as I am multitasking multiple meetings.
Good. We'll go back to number four on our informational item agenda.
Chair Cantu?
Yes.
We have one public comment on item seven.
Oh, we have a public comment on item seven. Okay. This is the time and place to hear anybody who wishes to comment on item seven. Is that person in the room or is that person? Okay. And we'll take a break after that, after this public comment.
Hello, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Cantu, for the opportunity to comment on the update of SCORP's San Diego River investigations. My name is Steve Jepson. I'm the Executive Director for the Southern California Alliance of Publicly Owned Treatment Works, or SCAP. We represent a little over 80 public water and wastewater agencies in Southern California. So I wanted to just add a little bit of perspective, and then I just have a few comments. As we all know, sewers are important for our society. The State Water Board is investing millions of dollars of public funds towards a septic to sewer program. So sewers are the best choice for conveyance of human waste to treatment facilities. We have about 120,000 miles of sewer in the state. That's halfway to the moon. To manage this vast, mostly gravity-powered system, there's over 1,000 agencies. And then, of course, several training and advocacy organizations, such as SCAP. We've been working with SCORP to provide collection system expertise for the development of the previously mentioned measurement devices and approaches to evaluating public sewer pipelines. And this has been a great collaborative effort so far. And we wish to stay engaged and continue to offer guidance and expertise as the investigation continues. And also want to have an open invitation to provide any kind of assistance or information to the Water Board or Water Board staff from a public sewer system perspective on this investigative order or any other wastewater collection system initiatives. And that concludes my comment for today, and thank you for taking my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Jepson. We'll take a 10-minute break at this time, and when we come back, we'll pick up on item number four. Thank you. Welcome back. We will start with item number 4 under informational items, San Diego River Watershed Update, Mission Valley USPS Annex Property Multi-Agency Cleanup Effort. Our Executive Officer, Dave Gibson, will start us off.
Excuse me. I believe we were asked, or this next item is actually number 4. I think it's the San Diego River Park Foundation update. And then we'll close with the USPS.
Okay. Property. Very good. I have my out of orders out of order.
And speaking today on behalf of the foundation are Rob Hutzel and Sarah Hockmacher.
Good morning. It's great to be here. I believe we have a presentation. Great. Sarah is our chief associate director. I am the president and CEO of the San Diego River Park Foundation and one of its founders. And Chair Cantu and board members, it's great to see you, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be before you. If we can see the slide, that would be great. Maybe you can get the clicker. That would be wonderful. The San Diego River Park Foundation, I think some of you may know that have been around a while. In 2000, there was a 34 million gallon sewer spill on Alvarado Creek. That was an effort where a few people like myself, a few of us got together and started to talk about what we can do about that. And over 20 years ago now, what we found was a river that was not connected to our community, a river that had largely been forgotten and abandoned. And we set out to change the course literally of the river's future. So the San Diego River Park Foundation started with, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 people. I was one of them. We're now over 50,000 people on our social media network. So it's pretty exciting to be here before you today and have awesome people like Sarah and my incredible team who do all the work, and I just get to talk a little bit. So thank you so much again for allowing us to be here today. All right, got to figure out how to work. There we go. So as I mentioned, we were formed in 2001. We do a lot of stuff. And it, as you can imagine, trying to engage people with the future of the river takes a lot of forms. We started off as a group that started to pick up trash out on the river. We've been doing it for 20 years now, sadly. I never thought I'd be doing it this long. We also then started out on research and monitoring and data collection. We have a youth education program. We, of course, do advocacy work. We work toward the vision of a river-long park system, 52-mile-long park and trail system, and a whole bunch of other stuff that we do. And we're here to just talk about a little bit of what we do. Our board of directors are some of the people fairly prominent in town. And the idea of our board of directors was to bring together different voices, different perspectives. Often they were people that didn't agree. And if we could bring them together and find common ground, we felt that we could move forward. Today, I'm going to talk to you about the Healthy Waters Initiative, and Sarah's going to probably talk about that as well a little bit. And then also Sarah will pick up on the Trash-Free River Campaign or Clean River Campaign. So land acquisition, research and monitoring, and restoration in wild waters. So this is the Upper San Diego River. And when we talk about upper, what do we mean? We mean above the dam, so El Capitan Reservoir. So that is the upper river. It's an amazing place. If you've never been there, largely pristine. Most of it's Cleveland National Forest. I'll take that off. A lot of private inholdings too. And that's what we found it when we started was there was a lot of places that people thought were conserved in some format, but they weren't. And we set out to conserve those lands. But it's amazing, pristine area. Our land acquisition program has grown over the years. We partner with a lot of people. We're often called to say, hey, can you mobilize quickly to respond to an opportunity when one of those properties goes on the market? And that's what we do. We organize our wonderful volunteers and donors. Sometimes we leverage those with grants from San Diego River Conservancy or the state of California or many other partners. But often we have to act really quickly because these are private sales. They don't care. They just want to sell their land. Over time, we've conserved over 2,500 acres of land now, often through little half acre, acre, 4 acre, sometimes bigger ones. Currently, we're focused on the Ritchie Creek Ranch. If you're familiar with Mildred Falls and the Upper San Diego River, it is right upstream on Ritchie Creek. It's one of the last pieces of privately owned property on Ritchie Creek, and we're working with the landowner right now. He's a willing seller, and we're very excited to be able to move forward with 180 acquisition of 180 acres. You can see a little bit of Ritchie Creek. This map just represents some of the acquisitions that we've done in the area we call South Rim. And so the South Rim is kind of on the southeast side of the Upper San Diego River Gorge. The yellow parcels there are ones that we have acquired and currently own and manage. And you can see there's a whole bunch of all different size pieces of properties. And the green there is national forest land. The blue lands, purple blue, are lands that we're currently in discussions with the owners to acquire. And that larger piece there is the Ritchie Creek Ranch. So if you can see how that all fits together. That's a big part of our efforts here. Our Healthy Waters Initiative also, of course, includes our research and monitoring. We're doing a whole bunch of different things that all started with one of the grants we received from the state of California. We had an idea that even though we've been doing, gosh, more than 10 years of monitoring the lower river on a monthly basis, what's the condition of the upper San Diego River? What are the emerging threats? What are the things that maybe we can raise awareness about and be take an active role in conserving that beautiful, pristine water up there? So we use bioassessments. We've worked with the water board staff. A big part of our message today is we love Dave and his team. We love you guys. We love our partnership and our relationship. It's very positive and creative and I think making some really good progress. We also work with people like the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, who has been an active partner with us for more than a decade. Currently, we're working to install another wireless monitoring station here in Mission Valley. We have one up on our Boulder Creek property already. And then, as you can see there, we've do stream surveys at 7.5 miles of the upper streams. These are areas that are really remote. So it takes people that are maybe out there 8 or 10 or 11 hours hiking remote sections to figure out what the condition is. And we find some really cool things. So here are some things in the most recent survey. Sarah, do you want to take it from here?
In our most recent surveys, we actually came across quite a few species of special concern. These are a couple of photos that were all taken this spring. We actually found 2 pond turtles, 4 chorus frogs, 17 California chorus frogs, as well as this horned lizard and some 6 California newts. We had 3 rainbow trout, a 2-striped garter snake, and unfortunately also 3 whole cars in the upper San Diego River that had fallen off of Eagle Peak Road at some point in the past. But part of what we do is document the locations of these species of special concern to help guide any of the management priorities in that area and potential future investment in protecting their habitats, as well as looking for threats. So we also in those surveys documented and mapped occurrences of tamarisk, Himalayan blackberry, and a few small areas where we found fountain grass. And most of those areas are small infestations, so they're really hard to get to, but a reasonably small amount of work now could help potentially inform future protection of downstream areas. So all of that data is, we just finished all these surveys this spring and it's being compiled and shared with all of our partners in that upper watershed. So, that's not what I meant to do. We also do a lot of restoration in the upper part of the river watershed as well as the lower part of the river watershed. We do a lot of work to try to identify restoration opportunities that could work for members of the community who have no skills in that are particular to this work. Kids all the way through people who are very experienced. So some of the things that we do, like collecting acorns from our preserves so that we can then grow in nurseries to do plantings, are very accessible and easy for kids to do and really meaningful activities for families, but they do have a meaningful restoration impact on our properties as well. We did a big native planting with some baby oak trees that we had collected from acorns on the preserve in the area around a previously funded hydrant modification removal. And that was a SEP project that you guys approved up at Temescal Creek. And with the gold spotted oak borer, oak death that we're seeing on that property, we intend to continue these plantings so that we can help protect that creek canopy. We also have done a lot of invasive removal with some funding from the IRWM program. And we've removed this season, we removed over 4 acres of tamarisk from around El Capitan Reservoir. So that's just a kind of a glimpse of the types of work that we do, but really a lot of it has habitat benefit, but of course also some of these really thirsty invasives can help protect water resources as well.
So I think the last time we were here, we We're giving you an update on a SEP-funded project, which was included removing this hydro modification up at one of our properties at Eagle Peak Ranch. It was a great project, and it was a wonderful partnership with the team here, and we really appreciate it. That is all gone now. It's planted. It looks great. It's healing, as we like to say. We learned a lot. As part of that, also, we funded a whole strategy for the entire Temescal Creek to remove a whole series of hydro modifications. And we are looking forward to implementing those as we have funding available. One of the things that really showed up in that was the importance and significance of thinking long-term and having longer-term projects rather than maybe a one-year or six-month project. It's really essential to this work. Boy, Sarah and I are both doing the same thing, aren't we? So this is what that Temescal Creek, Eagle Peak Ranch, we call it, looks like. On the right is a graphic from that strategic plan, that the restoration plan that the SEP funded. And so you can see each of those numbers and letters are separate projects that we'll be moving forward on. The area on the left there is, you can see there's a lot of water, surprises people sometimes. And that's held back by some dams that were created for the cows that have been on that property for over 100 years. We are looking for opportunities to fund the restoration and removal of those dams to return an oak riparian canopy. Sarah, it's your turn. One thing I do want to mention before Sarah hops here is the Trash Free River campaign, as you probably can sense, is near and dear to my heart. It's where I started with the organization. We've been doing it a long time. It takes a wide partnership. Everybody from the city of San Diego, the city of CNT, the San Diego River Conservancy, a whole bunch of private funders, many, many partners working with a lot of different agencies as well, just trying to figure out how to do this. But it all starts also with an incredibly dedicated team like Sarah and amazing volunteers. And I just can't acknowledge them enough of all they do. Sarah.
Thank you. So the Trash Free River effort is definitely something that's one of our most well-known efforts. It's very visible that there's trash in the riverbed. And so it's something that a lot of people unfortunately associate the river with. So it's in a really important part of our ability to show that there's a need and also that we can make a difference in addressing this issue. So we work primarily in the lower river for this program. So this is just the polygons of the areas that we survey. We survey about 1,250 acres total, and that includes about 850 acres in the city of San Diego, mostly on the main stem of the river, although we also survey Formosa Slough and Chaparral Canyon downstream of Lake Murray. And then in Santee, we survey the entire riverbed within the city limits, as well as Forester Creek within the city limits. So that's about 350 acres out in East County. I've shared this before with this group, so I apologize for repeating myself. I'll make it quick, but I think an important part of the evolution of this program was that we have really leaned into having this be a data-informed approach, that we don't just show up where we see trash and do whatever as much as we can that day. We collect data on the locations of the trash, the types of trash, the approximate source of the trash, and that data is used to inform what the next steps are. So in some cases, that means working with the landowner to do their own cleanup. In some cases, it means doing advocacy. In some cases, it means we know whether to bring waders or shovels or Girl Scouts or Marines to do a cleanup. And then it becomes a cycle where we also are using that data to confirm that trash was in fact cleaned and has not reoccurred. So this is something that is relevant, I think, to the SCORC project or presentation you just had, and will also be relevant to the next presentation. But this data allows us to be a lot more effective. So last year, we did 118 of these assessments where we collected data on the location of trash in the riverbed on a rotating basis throughout the riverbed. And that allowed us to directly remove 191,000 pounds of trash just with our volunteers, as well as additional trash that was removed through with our data, but by partners like the City of San Diego or City of Santee or private landowners. And this was done by 835 volunteers. Many of them came out many times. They did almost 6,000 hours of service in the riverbed. So that's the cool thing. This is the bad thing, right? Even if we removed 200,000 pounds of trash almost last year, we're still seeing an increasing trend overall in the amount of trash in the San Diego riverbed. So this is data that comes from those 118 assessments that I mentioned, the teams that are going out twice a week, covering 2 to 4 to 5, 6 sections every single week. And what we see is that certainly we had a spike in this data as the beginning of the pandemic. And that spike hasn't completely leveled off yet. We're starting to see that maybe, but it's a little too soon to tell if it's actually leveling off. This chart also has the breakdown of trash by source. So you can see that those two bottom bars, the blue is the trash that's directly related to encampments. And we estimate that about three quarters of the stormwater debris that we see in the riverbed is also originally from an encampment that was carried to its current location by stormwater. So this is the breakdown of the location of the trash. So you'll see that the lower bar, the darker color, is the trash that's in the city of San Diego, and the lighter bars are trash that is in the city of Santee. So at today, there's about 202,000 pounds of trash in the riverbed that we have mapped. And it looks right now it's 63.7% of it is in Santee, even though that only accounts for 29% of the total land area that we survey. And so one of the reasons why I want to show this slide is because the question Rob always asks my team is, why don't we go get it? So in some of these areas, the trash is located very close to active encampments. And in these two pictures, these are just two examples, but in both of these areas, you can see the purple pins are active encampments. The green pins are trash that we could clean up. We never clean up any trash related to active encampments, not just for safety reasons, but because we are not in the business of cleaning up things that belong to anybody. So we only clean up trash that's been left behind once people have had an opportunity, hopefully, to move into more sustainable housing or have left for another reason. So any of the areas where we are seeing trash that's really closely linked to active encampments presents a really significant cleanup challenge. And then this is our encampment trends overall. So you saw some of this information in the SCORP presentation, but this is just has a little bit more detail because this is our ongoing assessment data rather than just the point in time census data. Although I'm happy to say that the trend lines for those two types of data collection line up pretty well, but this has a lot more finer resolution. So what we're seeing is the number of encampments is still quite high in most of the areas where we work, and is a significant contributor to the trash that we're seeing. You want to add something to that?
Sure. Thank you for listening. The addressing this issue in particular is, as you can imagine, is very complex. It's not a short-term thing. One of the things I often hear, and in fact, I've said it to myself probably more than once, is, aren't you done yet? You know, didn't you pick it up once? You know, no, we've picked it up hundreds of times. And the thing is, the trash keeps coming back and coming back and coming back. And sometimes for our amazing volunteers, it gets a little frustrating because they come back to the same spot and maybe it's worse than they thought it was clean. But we're going to keep at it. We're going to keep championing a clean, healthy river. We believe that there's opportunities for partnerships, and when we value the partnership we have with you and some of the creative ideas that you will see, the level of collaboration that you're going to see in the next presentation, I think you're going to be inspired by. And so we're here to be a partner and listen and learn and continue our good work. So thank you for that. I'm happy to take any questions. Sarah's the smart one, though, I'll just tell you.
Any questions?
Yes. Rob, you mentioned monitoring near the beginning of your talk. Can you elaborate on what you're monitoring?
Let me take that.
Sure. For the water quality monitoring?
Yes, whatever it is.
Sure. And so for the water quality monitoring, we collect, we have a YSI sond that does water chemistry data, as well as Gary and some of the teams also do some additional processing for nutrients. So they do nitrates and phosphates as well. So temperature, pH, DO, specific conductivity. This is a test. Gary's looking at me. I'm forgetting something. But those are the main water chemistry and then the nutrients.
And then I would add, we also have our whole biology. You know, we do bats and we do critter cameras and we do a whole bunch of other things that we do monitoring for too.
If I could throw one other thing that you mentioned, the bioassessment. In fact, just last week, Chad and his group from our staff go up with us and did Boulder Creek, which we do the first of every May, been doing it for a long time. So, and that may be the only continuous bioassessment that we've done, but that's the full-on all-day. Even Debbie was there to collect algae the last couple of years, so it's a pretty thorough measure of the upper area there. We'd like to do Temescal, but it's dry so often.
I appreciate that. We did do a bioassessment. Your staff actually did recently on Temescal Creek, and we've done a couple CRAMs on Temescal Creek, and so a whole range of things.
Is the location that you just mentioned, is that's the site that you referenced in terms of the wireless, the remote monitoring?
The current one that we have installed is on Boulder Creek, which mm-hmm. is just downstream of where the bioassessment happens. Just, I mean, a couple hundred feet maybe downstream. And then the new monitoring system that we're putting in, it will be in Mission Valley near Qualcomm Way.
And is that collecting the same information in terms of nitrates, phosphates?
Exactly. pH? Yeah. Same information. We've got an algae probe on that one as well. It isn't installed yet, but when it is installed, we will have an algae probe as well. And the difference will be that the teams that go out now manually visit 15 sites every month, and this will be installed permanently. So we'll have more current, you know, more running data.
Great. And then I also just wanted to ask broadly, clearly, it is a complex issue when it comes to people who are unhoused in these encampments, and it's directly impacting your work and your mission. You mentioned partnerships several times. Do you have partnerships with people who are working on housing, food security, again, complex issue, mental health? So how are you working with those partners?
Yeah. So we started working in 2018 to try to find a outreach partner that was willing to send outreach workers into the riverbed. We had this great data set of where all the encampments were, and we were like, we'll take you there. We'll go right down with you. And it took us until 2019 and early 2020 to formalize a partnership. And we now work with PATH San Diego, which has also the city's coordinated outreach contract for the city of San Diego. And I think for unincorporated county as well, I'm not certain about that. But they're a very well-respected outreach organization. And we partnered to write a grant together to hire an outreach worker that would focus exclusively on the riverbed. So that outreach worker, he's awesome. And we've seen some really great impacts with people getting housed and people just having increased trust with an outreach worker that hopefully puts them on a path toward being housed. But he's one guy, and he can handle a caseload of, you know, I think his current caseload is 40, but his boss would tell me that he probably can only handle 25. And we've got, you know, 200 to 300 people. So it's definitely something we're interested in, more partners for sure.
Yeah. And just to add a little bit to that, I mean, Sarah's in the trenches every day dealing with this, so she knows a lot more than I. We're also involved with the Regional Task Force on the Homeless and some of the other collaborative efforts there. One of the things that we learned early on was the folks living in the riverbed weren't being represented. And so we really set out to make sure that they had a voice in this process by counting them. And we do that quite a bit. We share the data. We have great partnerships with Caltrans and the city of El Cajon and many other groups. And we're always looking for ways to strengthen those relationships. The riverbed's a little bit different because most groups do not want to go there because it's not safe. And so we've actually had, as Sarah was alluding to, challenges where people really didn't want to go and provide services directly in the riverbed.
I will say also that PATH has anecdotally told us that they were really surprised when they started doing the census, that or the client outreach, that a huge majority of people, way more than they're used to, had never been enrolled in any of the client management like systems that the HHSA has. So it's a different type of population for doing outreach. So it's probably too soon to really evaluate the success or the return on the investment of these kind of programs, because there's some uphill battles to fight with, you know, developing trust first with people who in many cases have been experiencing homelessness for 3 or more years.
Well, you mentioned before, I mean, I think that that's all fantastic. And you mentioned early on sort of the impressive number of people who follow you on social media and sort of who you count as members of your organization. I would just encourage you to use that power of those numbers and those people in terms of your advocacy work, not just on your own direct mission, but on this other work that's impacting. I think, you know, we've all been hearing recently about how and personally, I live downtown in Little Italy, and so I've seen the swell in the last 2 years. And, you know, I have young kids who are asking a lot of questions, and it is a difficult question to answer. But I think we are quickly, I think we're at a point in this region where we all recognize, you know, the dramatic issue. And we're certainly coming to a point where we recognize the need for housing, and there's going to be pushback in terms of the NIMBYism with housing. And as much as I think we can all band together and use our advocacy voice to address that issue, would be positive.
I completely agree. I think that we saw after the Hep A outbreak in 2017, when the way that people that were experiencing homelessness that were on living on streets was the way that they changed the approaches to interacting with those people, including increased enforcement. We saw an 80% increase in the number of encampments in the riverbed. So it's really important to us to also just maintain this data set, the data set and the expertise on what's going on in the riverbed, because as the region makes different investments in hopefully housing and some of the more compassionate approaches, but also in enforcement and those kinds of changes, we anticipate that having an impact on the river, and certainly appreciate the attention of state agencies that can help us elevate that if and when we see those kinds of spikes.
You'd mentioned that some people are reluctant to do outreach activities because they feel it's not safe. Mm-hmm. Is it their perception that it's not safe, or is it objectively not safe?
I can say from my perspective, we feel very safe interacting with people in the riverbed because we have a lot of experience of where we are and how to get out of the place that we're in if something does feel uncomfortable and all of those kinds of things. So I would say it's a lot more to do with the fact that when you're in dense vegetated areas and you don't know which way is back to your car, it can be intimidating to be an outreach worker working solo, which a lot of outreach workers work by themselves. So on a sidewalk, when you're in public view, it's a very different perception of safety, I think, than if you're deep in the riverbed and you don't know exactly the fastest way to exit.
Mm-hmm. There's some, if I can comment on that one.
Go ahead. I was going to say, but there are real cases where it's not safe. So, you know, and maybe that's what you were going to mention, but especially with a lot of the folks who are dual diagnosed. In other words, they have a chemical dependency and a mental issue, health issue, and they're fine. And then they're not. Mm-hmm. And that not period of time is where people might get hurt. And so that's the part that people are just rightly so, you know, scared about. So,
yeah, I was going to kind of use the term naivety. Remember 2010 census, the Census Bureau wanted to know if we could, some of us could guide their counters down along the river to get a count. And so myself and other, we went out and we kind of surveyed an area that was, we thought was pretty safe, and we could take them in there. Then they came back and said, okay, but we want to go down there at 7 o'clock on Friday night. And we all in unison, are you crazy? You go down at 7 o'clock Saturday morning when they're all sleeping and you count. You know, not when there's that thing. And the other thing I would caution is that I've always said there's different kinds of homeless, and the people that take the time and the effort to hike half a mile down into the brush and build an encampment down there are not the same people that are sleeping on a curb. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them are, they will come, we've had them come out and tell us, you know, I'll bring my trash out, but I can't be around people. And he did. We literally gave him bags and he went in and filled them up and brought them out to the trail and left them for us to carry away. So naivety, you have to understand that a lot of these people really are sick and have serious problems, and you don't just, and the only other comment I would make is to Rob's, 10 years ago, I was much less concerned. Now there's I sense a certain belligerence. I've had people literally come out and say, this is my home, get out of here, I'll turn my dog loose on you. And you know, we're saying, we're not here to bother you, we're just carrying the trash out. And you know, so we never used to see that.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, in doing this for 20 years, there's been a lot of changes over time. The one constant is us. We will be out there and we'll continue to try to figure it out. But we also recognize humbly that we don't know the answer. And so that opens some doors to creative solutions. And we're very open to that and looking forward to hearing the next presentation.
Thank you very much. Our next presentation, our last informational item, is number 4 on your agenda, San Diego River Watershed Update, Part 1, Mission Valley, et cetera. Thank you, Lori.
Still good morning. Wait for the pictures to show up. Good morning, still. Chair Cantu, members of the board, it's great to see you all in person. And the informational item, the last of our set today, is about a specific cleanup, thank you, Abby, that occurred in the San Diego River watershed. And this informational item is a success story. And it's a success story, not only because it improved water quality and got a significant amount of trash out of the river, but it was a collaborative effort between multiple agencies, federal, state, and non-government organizations to do this cleanup earlier this year, late February, early March, on the United States Postal Service Mission Valley Annex property. That's why everybody's...
The rollerball. Okay.
I like to use the down arrow. More control. These are the collaborative partners that worked on this particular location to remove the trash. It is Sean from the United States Postal Service, Sarah from the River Park Foundation, Carl with Caltrans, Monica is here from MTS, as well as Stephen from the City of San Diego. He's not with us today, but I have his notes. And then both myself and my colleague, Eric Becker. No, he's upstairs working at a different meeting. Those are the folks that participated in this particular cleanup when Rob Hutzel from the River Park Foundation reached out to Dave Gibson. And much like Gary, except Gary's actually in the trench regularly, I've been in the trench one time and work at it on my desk to try to really work on probably one of the pollutants that's most near and dear to me is trash. And when I see the pictures that were shared by the River Park Foundation of this particular location, I took the ball and I ran with this one. And I'd like to do it again in the future with other locations throughout our region, because I'm a firm believer that the reason why this particular cleanup got conducted as fast as it did is because each of these collaborative partners brought the full weight of their agencies behind their efforts and they were willing. Each of these agencies have performed cleanups like this before on their own properties, but this was a collaborative effort to assist the Postal Service because this particular location, like Sarah mentioned, is very difficult to get to. And the other agencies who have done cleanups like this on their own property, I think really could empathize, and they shared the desire to get it done as quickly as possible. This is where the cleanup was located, in the lower portion of the San Diego River watershed. You're all very familiar with what this looks like now. And this particular area is on the United States Postal Service property that's in the San Diego River, just west of the 805 bridge that bridges over the San Diego River, and just south of MTS's tracks. And I identified it with the yellow circle. And we zoom in a little bit. Sarah will talk more about the specifics of this location, but you can see kind of in the middle left lower aspect of this photo, the source of this amount of trash was a very large encampment, and it extends also underneath the brush to the right of the photo. So that part of the encampment just happened to be visual from the sky.
Sorry, Lori, how big is that?
Good question. I don't know in terms of acres.
The whole camp was about 0.05 miles long, so maybe 200 feet or so, something like that. So it's a pretty compact area, but very dense.
Thank you. And had been there for quite some time. And it was, as I understand it, active at the time that the River Park Foundation brought it to our attention. So we had to deal with that in terms of the trash cleanup as well. These are our partners in this effort, and I will call each of them up to say just a few words about their roles in terms of this cleanup. So I'll start with Sarah.
Yeah, and then I have this one. Hello again. This is just a marked up version of the map you just saw that has a little bit of to help convey the logistics that we were talking about. So the project area we're talking about is on the north bank of the river. It's only about 100 feet tall and 200 feet wide where the main work area was. It's bounded by the unfenced trolley tracks on the north side by open water on the south side. The River Park Foundation actually owns the property to the west. So it's a very small little piece of property, but it's a steep slope. It's densely vegetated. And the trash on the property was primarily related to a cluster of encampments that are those purple pins that you can see in the upper left part of the property. With the time that we visited with the Postal Service, there were three tents at that location, but it had varied over the years probably to have anything from one person up to, we estimate, probably no more than about six at a time. You can see in this map that our recommendation for getting the trash off the site was to be hauling trash alongside the trolley tracks, going through vegetation, crossing the river, and then through vegetation again to exit under the Caltrans property. So it involved coordination with a lot of different partners, which is what we're going to be talking about today. It also, because it was an active encampment, it also meant coordinating with the city of San Diego to work with their code enforcement and police department to visit the people that were living in that encampment.
Hi, good morning, members of the board. My name is Monica. I'm MTS's manager of right-of-way engineering, and I'm the one that kind of helped on behalf of MTS facilitate and coordinate with the different stakeholders. On behalf of MTS, I want to say MTS is very proud to have played a key role in the watershed multi-agency cleanup, and it was our pleasure to waive fees, expedite permits, and provide our right-of-way expertise to help facilitate a safer and more efficient work environment. In collaboration with all stakeholders, MTS developed an access route where equipment would be used to haul large volumes of trash away from the river without the need of multiple crews. This improved safety by limiting the number of workers necessary to be adjacent to an active railroad. So it's a little bit different working next to railroad operating right away. MTS takes safety very seriously, and together we were able to strategize the most efficient way to get the work done without compromising safety. For the duration of the project, MTS had flaggers were always on site to keep workers safe and alert of incoming train traffic. Through the use of MTS and Caltrans right away, the team was able to use a safer and more direct route of travel. It was great to see how everyone came together to help facilitate a meaningful effort to help protect one of our local water sources. We appreciate this partnership and many more like it in the future. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Carl Savage. I'm here to represent Caltrans, and we too are thrilled with the opportunity to be able to help clean up with this effort with Lori and her coordination. We provided access to the Caltrans right-of-way underneath the 805, which was a rather large graded area down there so that the trash could be hauled in and out. We also had offered to provide our packer truck, which is like the city dumpster truck that we have, but the team decided it was best to use roll-offs, and we cleared those roll-offs out every night. We waived all the permit fees and actually provided an escort, which basically bifurcated the entire permit process. So we had having an escort on site, we could waive our entire permit process. We think this is great that the Water Board encourages stuff like this, because we struggle as an agency to get some of these cleanups done especially when interacting with other agencies, federal agencies, state agencies, MTS and others that we all have to deal with when we do a lot some of these cleanups. And I think an experience like this with the Water Board is a great step forward for some firsthand experience of some of the stuff that we struggle with in trying to clean these things up. Again, thrilled to help put the weight of our agency behind things like this, willing to do it again as opportunities arise. Thank you.
Chair Cantu, we have one more comment from Sean Sarkowski.
Yeah, Sean is, we'll get to him in just one moment. He is our United States Postal Service contact. So I appreciate Monica and Carl. Those were key parts to it, to make the entire thing work and provide the support that the Postal Service needed to do. So it's a significant logistical challenge. And I appreciated MTS waiving fees, putting applications to the front of the line. Carl did the same, as did the city of San Diego. Stephen can't be with us today, but I would like to share his comments on the support that the Environmental Services Department provided to this effort, from something as small as needing to be get a Zoom link. He provided Zoom links for all the meetings that I was organizing, because the Postal Service, it was easier for them to get on Zoom than it was Teams. And Stephen was there at the drop of a hat. On more a substantive level, the Environmental Services Department coordinated with the San Diego Police Department and getting their documentation in place called a letter of agency. If the Postal Service needed that in order to get the police department services available to post the notices and provide security if needed. So Environmental Services would also assist, even if it was a non-government agency. This happened to be the federal government's property, but if it was someone like the foundation, they would also assist with linking even a private property owner with the police department through that letter of agency process. The San Diego Police Department Neighborhood Policing Division was present on site and they offered services. It's my understanding that no inhabitants accepted the services, but they were offered there if they wanted to accept them. So Stephen's contribution was really important to the overall success. Getting down to the Water Board's role in this, like I had mentioned when Dave brought me the Rob's information, I took it and I said, okay, I'm gonna lead it. I know who to get into the same room or get into a room. I called Carl. We found out, we got to meet Monica. Now I know Monica from MTS, and I feel more informed to be able to do this again in the future, knowing all the proper players to get into the room, because that is the key. Also, I tagged on my coworker, Eric Becker. He's the senior engineer for the Wetland Restoration and Protection Unit, which is the unit that would permit any sort of action if you had to dredge or fill activity in a river. Eric reviewed it and facilitated the action such that permits were not an impediment. Carl mentioned that, again, all these agencies perform these cleanups, and sometimes our regulatory processes get in the way of the greater good, sometimes. There's no promise that the next cleanup would be as easy as this one, but I think what the commitment would be is, my commitment is that we'll work our very hardest to get the right people in the room and to try to make it as easy as we can make it. With that, I would like to bring Sean Sean is the, I'll have him introduce himself, but he is the, with the United States Postal Service and the one responsible for doing the cleanup.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. And I apologize, I couldn't be there in person. I'm out of the area in a work-related meeting. So do you want to, do you have the slides that you could show? Can you guys hear me okay?
Hey, Sean, we'll do my slide. This is Sarah. We'll do my slides first, and then we'll come back to your slides.
Okay, great.
So this chart, I know you've been seeing a lot of charts from the River Park Foundation, but this chart shows the trash estimates on the U.S. Postal Service site. The benefit of that geospatial data that we collect is that we can run that data analysis based on property boundaries or jurisdictions. And in this case, we could run it for the specific parcel boundaries. There was a large cleanup effort that was done by the U.S. Postal Service in June of 2019. You can see that big dip after the cleanup happened. That cleanup, like this one, focused on the north side of the river. So that kind of baseline of trash that's still on the property is scattered trash that's on the outside of this current project area, but definitely something that Sean and team have on their radar. At the recent peak, we estimated that the trash was about 12,000 pounds. And as you'll see on some of these next slides, it was actually even greater than that once they started to do the archaeology of the cleanup. The trash was even greater extent than we had estimated. So we've been out to resurvey. In fact, we were out yesterday, and the trash in this project area is still, there's still no encampment. There's still no trash that has reoccurred yet, but that's definitely still something we're working on. I mentioned that the majority of this trash we mapped was related to encampments. So this is just the data, the breakdown of the trash that was on the property. When we brought this to the Water Board, more than half of the trash was related to active encampments, as well as another 33% related to inactive encampments. So that's, you know, 85% of the trash on the property was encampment related, as well as probably some of the stormwater debris that had washed in from encampments upstream. After the cleanup, they removed basically the entire active encampment area, as well as some of the inactive encampment litter. So that trash level was significantly down. And what's left on the property there is, again, still some stormwater debris and some inactive encampments, as well as some what we call special removal needed. In this case, it's mostly mattresses and wet things that are in the water that are gonna need a little bit different approach. Okay, so I think the next one is going to be where we'll have Sean back unmuted. He's going to talk through a couple of slides. Sean, can you see the slides from where you are?
I can, and you can hear me, correct?
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, don't mute me there. Yeah. Well, first, I wanted to say thank you really to everyone that came up and spoke and talked about their part in this, but in particular, Sarah and her group, because as you look at the property right here, this is our before and after. There's a lot that went into getting it from this to this. And we had a lot of removal with it, but the location of our property and being a federal property is the access is not easy. You know, you're trekking through mud, through thick brush to get to the property to view it, let alone going there and getting a team of people to come out there and clean that up. So could we go to the next slide, please? Just a little bit more showing you where we're at here. Very large area of encampment that was cleaned up. And something to add on to is we also got approval for the residual cleanup that Sarah had mentioned. There's some trash there from other encampments that we're going to continue to work on in the next few weeks. And if you'd like to continue through, we just got some different angles and views here. Sarah, do you remember what we talked about, what the total number came out to? Is it a little bit closer to 20 tons of trash?
We can go straight to that slide. In fact, this has the breakdown for you.
Yeah.
We have 12,000 pounds overall of regular trash, but the contractor that the Postal Service hired also sorted out, of course, all of the other disposal items. So in total, about 12,500 pounds.
Yeah, lots there with it. So you kind of see the scope and the size of what we had done there. And if you just want to kind of keep going through it, it's fine.
Thanks, Sean.
All right, thank you. Is that the last slide we got?
We have one more. Hi, Sean. It's Lori.
Hi, Lori.
So just stay on the line with me. The last slide is the potential next steps. And I think this group appreciated the success of this effort. And we, even at Sean's recommendation, that we might convene a group of agencies that stay connected for these types of cleanups within the San Diego River watershed. We will look to invite a few more agencies, perhaps Santee, and learn from their experiences. I think Sean was right. He said it was really great to have all the folks in the room that had done this before, and we don't, we just got to it faster because we learned. And a lot of credit does go to Sarah because she's out there all the time. As I understand it, Sean, the Postal Service has increased your signage and you're working on the future invasives habitat removal and even some future monitoring. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we know, we learned a lot more about the property from being out there and knowing kind of what goes on. We put permanent signage out there where the property is posted for private property. And we also, the main thing is, you know, the reason why you're kind of looking at, hey, well, this is going to happen in the future is we knew the importance of getting this cleaned up. So we worked to get this cleaned up. That was the first part of it. And then the next part is going to be to assess what are the best options. Like we said, working together, is it removing the invasive species of the trees or how do we work and have the least amount of impact on the environment there and be able to keep it clean. And we also understand that it's going to be an ongoing process. So as long as we are the owners of the property, I really think part of that is, and from what everybody else has said too, is that it's mitigation and keeping eyes on it. And if you notice something earlier, this didn't happen overnight. And if we can get a little bit, have the property more closely monitored, we can prevent people from living out there for extended periods of time and creating this kind of problem.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sean, for your willingness and your expeditious actions to get this cleaned up. And we're here to help. So thank you guys for your attention.
Thank you. Any questions for Lori Walsh and her tremendous team?
Lori, just a quick question. From start to finish, how long did this take?
Ah, good question. April. So September to April. Yeah, it was pretty, it was fast. Yeah.
So Lori, from something Rob said earlier and Sarah, can't be a one-shot deal. How often do you think it's necessary and appropriate to clean up this property and to expand the operations of this group, very remarkable collaborative group?
Great question. I think now that the Water Board, the foundation, also the other agency partners, we have Sean's contact and Sean has ours. So if Sarah ends up seeing anything accumulate based on their observations, I think the phone call to Sean occurs. We could get involved if we needed to, but I know Sean's really working on ways to not have that accumulate again. This area is very difficult to get to. And so some of the other options that the Postal Service is considering might be those invasive removal that controls the habitat for anyone deciding to come back to that particular location. So in this particular area, my hope is that we don't have to do it again because some of these other measures are going to be implemented. But throughout the San Diego River as a whole, I think that's where Sean had a great idea to convene this group on some appropriate frequency to get some of the other agencies involved, like the City of Santee and maybe the Sheriff's Department and some of the other players that deal with cleanups in those areas.
Yeah. And hey, you can still hear me, correct?
Yeah, Sean.
It's just the one last thing I wanted to add. And then I do apologize. I have to step in another meeting you know, there's a difference because we understand that picking up trash and everything, that's an ongoing thing. That's a big difference between having to bring heavy equipment and teams of people down there. And yeah, that's the main goal, is to really get it to be like basic housekeeping as opposed to what we do here. And now that we're all connected, it's great, because like I said, with the River Park Foundation, with all the great things that they're doing and being down there and being connected with Sarah, hey, it's a quick call, it's a quick text. Hey, something's going on down here, you let us know. We were just talking the other day, and I think that will be what we're kind of saying is that we've gone a long time without talking, and now that we're back connected again, we know that what to focus on. So we'll get success with it.
Definitely. They do text each other. They've been texting each other all morning. So that's a success. So thank you very much.
Thank you guys.
And thanks for the entire team for your cooperation to get this done. So this is the kind of water quality problem that we're always concerned about. And it sounds like you've made a great progress on addressing the water quality issues. But we also have an unaddressed social and economic and mental health issue, which is not our purview. But it's definitely something that's going to take many different people in our community to come together to harbor the resources and do more than just kind of rusticate people from A to B, but rather start creating an environment where people can thrive and heal and do well and not find themselves unhoused. So that is a greater task for our community. Thank you. We have our last agenda item, and that is board member requests, future agenda items. We recommend a course of action and estimated staff hours to address action items from March 2022 meeting. And is Kelly in the room to address this? I don't.
Kelly Dorsey's upstairs monitoring the meeting remotely, but we're ready to take notes, and she'll be taking notes as well.
Okay. Well, does somebody want to give us a estimate of, I don't remember what the agenda items were that came out of our March meeting, but is there a time frame that you have worked on?
Kelly can also speak. She's a panelist on the Zoom meeting.
Very good.
I am here. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I believe in the executive officer's report, which I'm pulling up right now.
Right.
There was an estimate for March.
That's right. Good. In the meantime, do any of our board members have any additional agenda items you'd like to have the staff address? Henry.
I don't know if it's the staff. I think all of us have seen the pictures of ours, but all of us can. The water that used to end up as snow as the snowpack is still out there. You probably noticed in your travels that the Pacific Ocean is still there. And you might wonder, where is it going? And I would like to suggest that we have Marty Ralph from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, who is a long-term scholar about atmospheric rivers, come and talk to us about that.
Thank you.
Chair, this is Kelly again. We had a request last time to meet with SWRP. We estimated that it would take 10 staff hours, and that was for board member Barbanel and board member Strawn to go and meet with SWRP.
And Betty Olson as well.
And Betty Olson as well, yes. That was an ad, yes.
Very good. So that's still pending? That meeting's not taking place?
It is not taking place yet.
Presently scheduled for May 26th. That was postponed for health reasons among the SWRP staff and might be again postponed, but we're planning on doing it when it's safe.
Very good. Well, we look forward to the results of that meeting. Be no further business, we will adjourn for lunch and convene in a closed session. Our attorneys, Vincent Vu and Lori Okins, will provide a brief explanation of what our board members will discuss during the closed session.
Thank you, Chair. Today, the board will be meeting in closed session to discuss items number 9J and 9K. On the agenda, these are the litigation matters with the United States International Boundary and Water Commission. The board will also be meeting closed session to discuss item number 11 on the agenda, which is the administrative civil liability complaint for the Portola Center South construction site. And item number 13 on the agenda for board personnel.
Very good. At the end of that, we'll come back here and announce if there are any results of our deliberation and formally close the meeting. Do we have an estimate of how long we think closed session might be?
I think closed session might take about an hour or an hour and 15.
Okay, thank you very much. Good, well, we are adjourned to closed session. Thank you. Thank you.